Thank you. So, mic working? I guess I can hear it. Okay. So I'd like to thank the organisers for getting me over here. It's been really nice to visit Canada. I haven't been here before. In deference to Neil, I'm adding something to my title here. So we're talking about quantum memory. We had a paper recently where we called it room temperature, and Neil quite correctly pointed out that 80 degrees is not very room temperature unless you're in a sauna. So this is the system I'll be describing today. It's a gas cell memory system, and this is a picture of our gas cell here. In this case, it's being illuminated with about a third of a watt of laser, so you can see the rubidium atoms glowing. But I guess it's not doing that when we're storing small pulses. So these are the people who have been working on the system recently. Ben Sparks is here as well. He'll be talking on Friday morning about some spectral processing applications of our memory. So I won't go any further on that stuff in this talk. Come to his. So the motivation for all this work, I guess the primary motivation for quantum memory at the moment is to do with quantum key distribution. So Charles Bennett was saying in his talk, he gave this example with this nice demonstration of quantum key distribution under Lake Geneva, where they showed 67 kilometers of key distribution, and that's all really nice. The limit for these sort of systems at the moment in fibers is around 100 kilometers. Beyond that, the losses in the fiber mean that key distribution becomes really difficult and slow. So if we draw a 100 kilometer ring around Canberra, key distribution at the moment within government departments in the city, I mean, that's something that you can do. And in fact, some collaborators of ours in a private company called Quintessence are actually working on that right now to build a QKD network in Canberra between government departments. But other than that, there's just a few sort of sheep hanging around out here that probably aren't that interested in what you have to say to them using quantum keys. It gets even worse if you put Canberra in context with the rest of Australia. It's really a long way from anywhere. And then it gets even worse again. So if you're talking about quantum key distribution over something bigger than a city, you really need some sort of a solution. And one of the proposed solutions to this is the quantum repeater. And this is a schematic. It works something like this, that you distribute entanglement between a whole bunch of nodes and do entanglement swapping operations between these nodes until finally you can do this final entanglement swapping operation, and then this allows you to extend the range of quantum key distribution by sharing this key between the nodes. No one really knows what the quantum repeater is going to look like. There are a few different proposals, but quantum memory seems to be a key part of them because you need to store the entanglement of these nodes for some amount of time. There's also applications for quantum memory within quantum computing, of course, if you want to have sort of systems that store intermediate results of quantum computers. If you have a computer that uses optics, then an optical quantum memory might be something that you really want to have. So that's sort of the motivation for looking at optical quantum memory. And so then what you're trying to do is store optical states of light. So there could be single photons, there could be weak coherent pulses, there could be parts of entangled states or squeezed states. So you want to find some sort of system that can store and recall these states of light. Crucially, of course, what you've got to do is have a storage system that never measures the thing that you're storing, because if you measure it, then you break it. Obviously, that's what quantum mechanics tells you. So you need systems that store light without ever measuring it. So this is going to be an outline of the rest of the talk. I'm going to introduce a technique called controlled reversible inhomogeneous broadening and gradient echo memory and show how these two things are connected. This is the technique that we particularly use for our memory. And then go on and talk about the experiments that we've done with our system to date. So I want to consider some ensemble of atoms like this, and they're all different colours because they have slightly different absorption frequencies. So this would be the situation, for example, if you have, say, rare earth ions in a solid state medium. They're all in their own little local electronic environments, and so they've been stark shifted by the crystal lattice. And so you're going to have a lot of different absorption frequencies, massive inhomogeneous broadening. And so compared to, say, the natural, is there a laser pointer here? Oh, this dashed line here is the natural sort of frequency of these atoms. Maybe they've been shifted upwards, for example, and there's three different lines there representing three different colours of atoms that have been shifted. Now, the thing is, what you can also do is you can apply an external field, like an external electric field, and deliberately shift the frequency of the thousands around by applying a stark shift. So if we imagine how that looks now, we've got a pulse of light coming in here, and it's going to be absorbed by these atoms that shifted away from their natural resonance. Pulse comes in, and we get some absorption, and each of these atoms will rotate around the block sphere at different frequencies, the frequency determined by the detuning. When you reverse the detuning, all these vectors will rephase, and at some point you get the light out again. This is a photon echo. So basically what's happening there, light's absorbed, everything rephases in a controlled way at some rate. You reverse the process, it's completely reversible in net dynamics, as long as you're doing this within the spontaneous emission time of the system. So that's the important part. All this stuff, if you're talking about a grounded excited state, you need a long-lived excited state. Otherwise you're going to be destroyed by spontaneous emission. So that's a limitation on a system that uses an optical coherence like that. But in some of these solid-state systems, that's kind of reasonable because you can have lifetimes of several milliseconds. And that's already quite a long time for storing light. So the problem, if you go back to this ensemble here where you've now shifted all the atoms around using your external field, is that if you imagine, say, a red photon is absorbed by the red atom and then you re-emit it, it might be reabsorbed by another red atom as it tries to travel out through the crystal. You can get around that by engineering a system where the light comes out backwards, but if you're trying to get it out forwards, that's a problem. So the gradient echo memory is a system where you apply a gradient, a field gradient across your ensemble. So you've got high frequencies at one end, low frequencies at the other. The pulse comes into your system, and then at some point you flip the field, and then all of the atoms rephase, and eventually your pulse comes out like that. So the gradient echo memory then, you have no reabsorption because of the monotonic frequency distribution of the atoms, and the efficiency approaches 100% in the limit of high optical depth. So this is kind of exciting. This is some work back in 2008. There are a couple of papers there with mysteriously similar publication numbers. It's very strange. But the thing that Gabriel, a former PhD student of ours, went on to describe was a really nice description of this memory using a normal mode. So these are the two equations in time and space that govern the memory. Got the optical field, atomic polarization, the gradient comes in over there, and the atom-light coupling. If you take the Fourier transform of these equations, what you find is some combination of the electric field and the atomic polarization that propagates as normal mode in a very similar way to a normal mode in the EIT, except in this case, the normal mode lives in Fourier space. And the way this thing sort of looks, if we give an example here of a modulated pulse, so right-hand side there, we've got the electric field as a function of time. And this is how it looks. This is how the electric field or the optical field looks. It comes into the memory at this time here, and then it will propagate up to a position in Z, so we're looking along the memory as a function of Z, up to a point where it reaches atoms with the same frequency, and it absorbs at that point. So we just look at the absolute values, and then you see this. And what you see also is that the pulse shape is reversed on recall. So the way this protocol works, light comes in, it's absorbed in the middle of this picture here, we're reversing the gradient of the field, and the optical field is regenerated, and the light comes out, but it comes out backwards. If we look at the atomic polarization now, this shows all the phase information, but if we look at the absolute value, then it becomes clear why Fourier analysis in this system is kind of good, because what you've done really is taken the pulse and split it up into different frequency components. Different frequency components are absorbed at different places longitudinally along your memory. And so if you look in cross-section through the atomic polarization, what you see is a Fourier transform of your input pulse. Okay, so this is kind of an intuitive reason for why the normal mode of the system lives in Fourier space. So now we take that atomic polarization and the electric field together and take a Fourier transform to find the normal mode. This is what the normal mode looks like in absolute value, and the normal mode, because you're taking the Fourier transform again, its cross-section is the same as the temporal cross-section of the original pulse. Now, here I've shown an example where the atomic frequency gradient is turned over slowly. Rather than going from one gradient and then instantaneously to another gradient, you can turn it over slowly. The dynamics of this flip don't really matter for the way the memory works. You can flip it quickly, you can flip it slowly, you can jiggle it backwards and forwards. It doesn't really matter, as long as you do it uniformly so that at the end everything rephases. So the distance that you travel up in k-space then is kind of telling you how far the atoms have spun away from each other. So they're all spinning at different rates because they have different detunings. But how far you go up in k-space tells you how far the slowest one has spun away from the fastest one. And so the pulse that comes in first, which is this pulse here, goes furthest up in k-space, and it takes the longest to rephase, which is why the first pulse in is also the last pulse out. Okay, so this explains why the memory reverses the direction of the pulses. Make that more concrete, here's an example of four pulses. They come into the memory like this. That last pulse out there, when we flip the sign of the gradient, is also the first pulse out. So that's something that's a bit unavoidable if what you're doing is storing in two levels, because you've got this optical excitation. As soon as all these optical excitations have rephased, the pulses come out, and there's not really much you can do about stopping that. So, in fact, as I said at the beginning, we're doing a gas phase system, and in particular we're using rubidium. The excited state lifetime of rubidium is pretty short, it's a few nanoseconds. That's not really going to do much good if you're trying to build a quantum memory out of it. What rubidium has, it has some hyperfine ground states with a very long coherence time. So in fact in our system we don't use an optical two-level system, we use this sort of spin two-level system, where we use a really strong Raman coupling beam, which is the thing shown there in red, and this couples the two ground states, one and two, together into an effective two-level system. So as long as that control beam is on, everything I've told you now about the optical two-level system kind of carries forward into this spin system, except now the ground excited states are in fact these two ground states of the rubidium atom. Now that's, so there are, as I said, two-level systems with long coherence times are kind of rare. Solid-state systems do have that, but there aren't heaps of those around. And also, there are plenty of three-level lander-type structures that you can use in different different alkali atoms. And the wavelengths are kind of more favorable as well. I mean, we're working at a wavelength here of 795 nanometers. Some of the solid-state systems have quite inconvenient wavelengths where really dye lasers are still your best option. So three-level systems have some serious advantages. There's one more advantage you have with a three-level system as well, and that is, so this is, the blue here indicates the time when the control field, this Raman coupling field, which I'm going to call the control field, is on. You need that control field on in order to couple the two ground states together. If that control field is off, your two-level system is just vaporized. It's not even there anymore. So imagine a system now where we read the pulses in with the gradient on, we turn the gradient over, but whenever all of these block vectors come back and rephase at k equals zero, there's no control field on, so they just pass through down to negative k. We can flip the gradient again and turn the control field on and recall, and then we get the pulses out in the forward direction. So this is FIFO storage, first in, first out. So the three-level system allows you to recall either in the forward direction or the reverse direction, or indeed allows you to recall things in almost any which way you care to do it. So here's a model where we have seven pulses coming in, and we can turn the gradient flat, so there's no evolution in k-space, then turn the gradient down, so we recall pulses 4 and 3 in that order, turn it back up again, recall pulses 5 and 6, turn it back down again, recall pulses 1 and 2. Now in this case what we've done is actually reduce the power of the control field. What this does is it reduces the efficiency of the outcoupling from the memory. So in fact what's happened is that pulses 1 and 2, half of them have come out, and half of the engine, those pulses, have been left behind in the memory, or half the information about those pulses, I should say, has been left behind in the memory. So in this way you've got a kind of an atom-like beam splitter. You take your pulses, some is left in the atomic coherence, you recall some of that back out into the light. Now, I'm going to come back to that idea later in the talk. We've actually gone further into this beam splitting idea and done some experiments around that. You can also make the gradients steeper. To make the gradients steeper, you have a higher range of Fourier frequencies, and the crossing in K-space is faster, and so the pulses come out faster, and you have pulse compression. You can make the gradient more shallow and have pulse expansion as well. So these are the kind of possibilities you have with this three-level system and this gradient technique. So from there, we went ahead and did some classical light storage experiments. This is sort of a diagram of the experiment, how it looks. We've got some signal pulses that come in through a ring cavity, and these are 6.8 gigahertz detuned from the control field. That's the ground state splitting of rubidium-87. So they're combined on this cavity at different frequencies. These go into the memory cell, which is 20 centimeter long cell. That would work really well if you try ordering one of those. 20 centimeter long cell, got a half tor of krypton buffer gas, it's sitting around 80 degrees Celsius. We need to filter off the control field as well. So we have a filtering cell, this is rubidium-85. It absorbs the control but lets the probe pass through, the signal pass through. And then finally we have homodyne or heterodyne detection that we use to measure just the signal. So that's a kind of schematic of the experiment. Also we have magnetic field coils, and in this experiment what we do is we have a coil with varying helicity. So it's tighter at one end and looser at the other. We have a second coil that we can flip between them. So that in this way we can make a magnetic field gradient so you have a strong field at one end and weak at the other, and then reverse it. And this magnetic field gives you a Zeeman shift to the hyperfine ground levels. And this way you get the atomic frequency gradient that we require. So the results we have from this system, this is an example of pulse sequencing. So we put in pulses 1, 2, 3, and 4 that we tag by height. And in this example, we pull out 4 and 3 and then 1 and 2. So the pulse sequencing works okay. You can see the efficiency there isn't great, sort of the order of 10% or so. So these experiments were done a little while ago already. The pulse splitting, in this case, we recall the pulses twice, once in the forward direction, once in the reverse order, and once in the forward order, doing this trick where we go down through the k equals zero point and then back up through the k equals zero point. Pulse compression, so here these are two separate experiments now, where in one case we recall pulse quickly and get compressed pulse, another case where we expand the pulse. This could be kind of interesting if you're trying to match the bandwidth of a pulse to some other sort of optical system downstream, like a cavity or an atom or something. You want to try and tune the bandwidth of your system. So that's something I'm kind of interested in. And then finally, the efficiency. So these are more recent results now that were published earlier this year. After a lot of hard work by Marty, we managed to push the efficiency up to 87% recall at best. And you can see that the decay of the efficiency there is a function of time. So the decay time here is the order of a few microseconds, mostly limited by the control field, in fact. The control field is really bright. It causes spontaneous emission from the excited state, and mostly that's just because we detune by about 3 gigahertz. The Doppler bandwidth is around 500 megahertz. And so there's still quite a few atoms that get affected by that control field. In a cold atomic ensemble, we kind of expect that problem with the control field decoherence would go away to some extent. And in fact, that's one of the things we're working on now, is building a cold atomic ensemble to fix that problem, which we hope will extend the storage lifetime of our system. The other thing which limits the efficiency of our system, I should say, is that we have atomic motion, obviously. We're talking about a sauna temperature gas cell, and the atoms, although they're bouncing off the buffer gas, do diffuse. And in fact, when we measure the decay of our memory, we see that there's kind of a diffusion term in there. So diffusion and control beam are two things that are really limiting efficiency of our system at the moment. So they're all the results that we've done for classical light storage. More recently, what we've done is gone on to do some quantum benchmarking experiments. So in this example, what we're going to do is do a lot of homodyne measurements. Each set of data here is about 100,000 measurements, and what we're doing is we let a pulse of light through memory. Well, sorry, first of all, we measure, this is a measurement of the input. So we've got input pulses hitting our homodyne detector. The phase is randomly varying due to thermal and acoustic fluctuations. We don't actually drive the phase in any way, we just let it randomly drift. And we can measure the phase of our pulse using a stronger reference pulse that is frequency detuned from our local oscillator. So you've got to imagine there's a local oscillator coming to the homodyne, and first you get hit with a reference pulse, and that gives us, tells us what phase we've got in our system, and then we have the signal pulse. And so the reference pulse tells us whereabouts on the x-axis we are, and then the amplitude that we measure for that signal pulse tells us where we sit in the electric field strength, which is the field quadrature. So we build up a huge ensemble of these results like this, and then we do exactly the same thing where we store the pulse and then let it out. And what we find is that the signal amplitude hasn't decayed that much, which is what we expect because the memory is highly efficient. We can take statistics at any point along here, for example. What we see is the Gaussian distribution of data around the electric field. And so from these kind of ensembles of data, we can build up the complete state reconstruction of what was going in and coming out of our memory, be it in terms of Wigner functions or density matrices. So this is the density matrix reconstruction now for two inputs. The first one has around one photon, and the second one has around 16 photons. And they're the input density matrices. They're very close to coherent states. They're not fully coherent. There's a little bit of mixedness about them, a little bit of extra noise, which I'll come back to a bit later because it turns out to be kind of important. But when we measure the output density matrices, this is what we see. And we find for one photon a fidelity of 93%, and for around 16 photons a fidelity of 82%. So that's really good. I mean, the fidelity is a bit of a funny measure for quantum memories, and fidelity is a bit of a funny measure full stop, because it depends on the size and the nature of the state you're using to probe your memory. So, you know, you say, well, this one's 93%, this one's 82%, why does it work so much worse with 16 photons? The answer is it's not working any worse at all. It's exactly the same. But the problem is that any change in just the efficiency of the system means that these two blobs in the density matrix move further away from each other than they would for the case of a small number of photons. In the limit of having a vacuum state, a brick is a perfect quantum memory. You put a vacuum state into a brick, and you measure the quantum, the statistics of the vacuum state coming out of the brick, and you find it's the fidelity is absolutely perfect. So what the fidelity tells you for low quantum numbers is, do you have any added noise? That's all it's really telling you, okay? And the answer in our case is we don't have any added noise that we can really detect at all. So here's another way of looking at the data. This is the input. You can see if we just measure the average photon number for our pulses, we can just put a Poissonian fit, which is the blue line there, and we see that, again, it's not quite perfectly Poissonian, so it's not quite the ultimate coherent state that we're storing, but it's pretty close. Now we can look at the statistics. So this is taken off the diagonal of the density matrix, by the way. So we can measure the photon number. We can look at the output, and do a couple of transformations on the output statistics to see whereabouts we're sitting in terms of performance of quantum memory. So the blue line again is a Poissonian fit to our data on the output, okay? And we see that the output, like the input, is kind of Poissonian. The red line is showing the fit we would expect to see if we were at the quantum limit. Now the quantum limit would be the case where you naively take your data, split it into two parts, measure amplitude and phase quadratures separately, and pay the penalty of the quantum vacuum that comes in to your system like that. So the quantum limit is like the easiest, most obvious measurement you could do, which won't give you a quantum memory because you're doing, you know, complete destructive measurements of your state. But if you did that, then the amount of noise that you add to your system, you add that Gaussian noise to your system, and then ask what and assume the same efficiency that you have in your memory. So you take your input data, add that amount of noise you get for the classical quantum crossover, and then plot that distribution of photons, and the red line is what you get. The no cloning limit is another interesting limit for quantum memories. This is the limit where you've broken 50% efficiency, but you haven't got any projective measurements. So the added noise is less, and again, you can see that our data is well in excess of the no cloning limit if you look at it in this way. So moving on now to trying to put the difficult problem of trying to give a number to a quantum memory. I mean, this is a sort of a bit of a game in some ways, but people very often ask, you know, here's a quantum memory, how well is it working? How do you know? So the graph that I showed you is one way of doing it, but it's hard to compare different memories using that technique. So fidelity, as I've mentioned, is a very popular way of quantifying these things, but it has its pitfalls, and it becomes exceptionally clear in this case. So for very small photon numbers of a little less than one, we see a maximum fidelity there of 98%. This is what I mean by having no added noise. If we had added noise, then you wouldn't reach that kind of fidelity. And it sort of drops off as the photon number increases. The problem is that these black lines here, these black lines indicate the maximum possible fidelity that we could have reached with our system given the known efficiency of the memory. So for some of these points here, the system is working as well as the efficiency of the system allows. So the efficiency limits the fidelity, the added noise limits the fidelity, and if you see the black line hitting the red symbols there, then you know that you have no added noise. The two lines here, the bottom one is a half. The top one is the limit for a coherent state storage, or coherent state, the no cloning coherent state limit for fidelity, which is sort of a little bit over two-thirds, about 0.68. The problem here is, as I said, our states aren't quite coherent. They're a little bit mixed. So the black lines, in fact, also include that mixedness in terms of the fidelity limit. But the problem here is that, you know, with a given amount of mixedness in your states, you try and apply the coherent limit, and it doesn't really make any sense. You know, in fact, every time you make a measurement, you got to draw a new fidelity limit, and it's a little bit of a mess. So an alternative way of quantifying quantum memory is something that dates back to the QND days, and it's a sort of way of measuring the added noise and the efficiency of the memory together on a system with two axes. So the bottom axis is this thing called signal transfer, and what it is, you take the signal to noise ratio for the amplitude and phase quadratures. In fact, you take the ratio of the signal to noise ratios for the amplitude and phase quadratures on the input and the output, and you add them together. So if your signal-to-noise ratios are undegraded, perfect signal transfer, then the maximum value you can reach on the bottom axis is 2. Because signal-to-noise input, same as the signal-to-noise on the output. The vertical axis is the product of the conditional variances. Now, the conditional variance tells you how much noise is added to your amplitude and phase quadratures. If you add no extra noise at all, then your conditional variance will be 0. If you add lots of extra noise, your conditional variance can be as big as you like. So the ideal quantum memory has perfect signal transfer and no added noise. So the best quantum memory would be sort of somewhere down around about here at the point 2, 0. So in a way, actually, the bottom axis is measuring efficiency. That's mostly what signal transfer measures. And the vertical axis is really just measuring the added noise. So it turns out that if you break into this quadrant of the diagram here, you can really say that you've beaten the no cloning limit. And what the no cloning limit means is that the state you store in your memory, the thing that you recall, is the best possible copy of that state that exists anywhere in the whole universe. So there's no way that some eavesdropper has taken the information in your memory, that you thought you'd lost through spontaneous emission and scattering, and then reconstructed a better version of the thing that you've stored, that you know if you break into that region that the only sort of copy of your state is really the one that you've recalled deliberately from your memory. So the no cloning limit, I guess, has some sort of relevance for sort of QKD applications where you're worried about people eavesdropping on things that might be sitting in your memory. So that's the end of the quantum benchmarking experiments. The final thing I'll talk about is something that we've got an archive paper on at the moment, and this is going back to the beam splitting idea. So I want to think about a bit more the memory behaving as some kind of an atom-light beam splitter. So imagine now we've got the red beam here is the travelling optical wave, and this beam splitter in white is the operation that writes the information onto the atomic coherence. And we're going to have some reflectivity and transmissivity, which we can vary. If we have a strong control beam, we have very high reflectivity and close to 100% writing of the input onto the optical coherence. So that's what I've illustrated here. Now we can have a recall, for example, with a lower control beam power, where we extract some of the optical state onto another red beam, but we leave some of the atomic coherence behind. And then later on, getting ahead of myself here. The other thing we can do is at the moment we have this second recall, we have this recall operation, we can inject another pulse into the memory, and as we vary the phase of that second pulse that we're injecting, we can imagine what might happen as we look at the total recalled intensity from the memory. We can look for interference between the light that's recalled from memory and light that we're injecting into the memory at the moment of recall. And then later on, we can recall what's remaining of the atomic coherence and see if we can see that these two things are anticorrelated, as they should be, because if you're extracting light from the memory, there should be less left behind. Alternatively, you can get destructive interference and have all of the light coming in that second pulse stored in the atomic coherence. So, will this work? This is another way of looking at it, including now the coupling field dynamics. So on the initial storage stage, you have a strong coupling field and close to 100% storage, reduce the coupling field strength, and inject a second pulse here that will interfere with the first recall pulse, and then we recall the remaining atomic coherence in the third step. And this is what it looks like. So the red pulse, so first of all, this part here is the transmission through the memory. This is the leakage when the pulse first hits the memory. So in this case, the memory actually isn't that efficient because we have quite large leakage. Microphone's falling off. So the relevant parts that I was talking about before are these blue and red bumps here. We've optimized it to get the highest possible visibility for the second recall pulse. So that just means because the memory is decaying, you've got to inject a bit more power into that first pulse so that you get as equal as possible intensity for the two pulses on the second recall event. And so the visibility for that red pulse is around 68%, and the visibility for the first pulse is around 23%, but they're out of phase as we expected them to be, which is all very well and good. There's another trick, which is something that Jeff Campbell kind of dreamed up, where instead of having interference in the time domain where you inject two pulses one after the other, you inject them both at the same time, but at slightly detuned frequencies from each other. In fact, what you do is you store both these pulses in the same atomic ensemble, but using different control beam powers and slightly different probe frequencies. It's all detuned here by megahertz. In this case, what you expect to see is an interference between the absorption of these two pulses, depending on the relative phase of the two pulses. So you're really interfering the input input pulses during the absorption phase. So the way that looks then is you have a traveling optical wave here, two different frequencies coming in. We're going to vary the phase of one of those pulses, just the dark blue one, store it, and then recall. So what we expect to see is constructive and destructive interference on the initial storage and then the recall. And indeed, that's what we see here. We have visibility on the second pulse there up to 73%. Again, it's optimized to make that one to give that one the biggest visibility. And so this is, as I say, this is something which is a little bit new to us. Ben Sparks on Friday will also show some results, perhaps. Are you going to show those ones? Yeah. Similar sort of thing done in a different sort of way. So what is one of the things we're interested in now, I guess, in exploring is sort of this coherent atom light sort of interferometer idea and see how far we can push it and what sort of fringe visibilities we can get. So with that, thanks for coming along, and if you've got any questions or want to visit us, then you can find all of our coordinates there. Thanks.